This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Recently, a close friend of mine experienced an unexpected loss. Watching their family struggle emotionally and financially made me stop and think seriously about my own family's future. As the primary provider, I know how important it is to make sure that if anything ever happened to me, my family would still be able to manage. So I realized that without life insurance, my family would be left with overwhelming financial burdens. I looked into coverage before, but the process always felt complicated, got endless forms, phone calls, and medical exams, made everything take weeks. So that's why Ethos stood out to me. Their process is simple and 100% online. There's no medical exam required, just a few health questions, and you get a quote in as little as 10 minutes. In many cases, you can even receive same-day coverage without ever leaving your house. Ethos offers up to $3 million in coverage, with some policies starting as low as $2 a day, billed monthly. It's a trustworthy company that's changing the way people think about life insurance. So protect your family's financial future with life insurance from Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Brian. That's ethos.com/Brian. Application times may vary. Rates may vary.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
I'm so glad you're here. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way on. We get closer and closer to Thanksgiving. We're 48 hours from Thanksgiving. It's the beginning of the holiday season, the big rush, Black Friday and Cyber Monday. And what is it? Support your local small business Tuesday. I think that's all important. Meanwhile, we'll find out how healthy the economy is. And just keep in mind, too, if you're ever not near your affiliate, you always get the Fox News app and you get us. You can also get the podcast. This way you can get it on your schedule. I'm Brian Kilmeade Show, wherever you're comfortable getting podcasts. This hour, we're going to be joined by Daniel Hoffman, former CIA station chief, served in Moscow, Iraq, Pakistan, South Asia, Europe, about all these peace talks. We'll get his reality-based assessment. Keep in mind, too, that President Trump and First Lady Melania will participate together in the Thanksgiving Day pardoning. It looks like they have two turkeys, Gobble and Waddle, and only one will survive. So we'll see what happens. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I said something that was pretty simple and non-controversial, and that was that members of the military should follow the law. And in response to that, Donald Trump said, I should be executed.
Well, it's a little extreme, and it's not what he said. He said that what you did was treasonous. And I think it was not a legal treason movement, but why you cut a tape that told people in the uniform to feel free to go against what you consider an unlawful act or an unlawful order. Now the Pentagon has Senator Kelly in the crosshairs for taking part in that video, urging military members to challenge illegal orders without an example and, in my view, without cause. This just adds to the unrest. Now bring it into the military. Really?
Number two.
Putin wants legal recognition for what he has stolen, to break the principle of territorial integrity and sovereignty.
President's projection of power in the world stage is on display with China, Russia, and Venezuela. We will update all three and explain why I think we are all safer because we have a president confronting our nation's challenges head on.
Number one.
Some are going to come down in weeks. Some are going to come down in months. We just had the best month in the housing market due to affordability, due to increased supply, best October in 3 years.
Healthcare fix on hold for now as the president and his team go all in on affordability overall. Can he drive prices down in 2026? How do you view the economy? That's your question, only to you. And whatever you say is right. And what do you hope the president tackles next? So we'll talk about it, too, because some of the numbers don't look good in affordability. But the president's got this thing called time next year. So his policies, which I think are positive for the economy. I mean, certainly pro-growth compared to the previous administration's philosophies. They were trying to get rid of oil and gas. This administration is for drilling. They're for more legislation and more regulation. This is just the opposite. People do it responsibly, less regulation, more incentive to drill. That's going to get prices down. And if you get gas and oil down, more than likely, prices are going to come down because that's how it's transported for the most part. AAA gas prices, not down that much. Current 306, last year 305. So it's still low, could get lower. Affordability overall, you say, when asked, 85% say groceries are up. This is your perception. 78% utilities are up. 67% say healthcare is up. 66% say housing is up. 54% say gas is up. That's pretty much wrong. But, you know, you look at the, if you break down the Thanksgiving dinner, they say it's down from a year ago. So the question is, how do you feel about it? Forget about what the numbers say. How do you feel? And the president can do a lot to drive these numbers down. And I think it's pretty important he does that. Howard Lutnick was talking yesterday, and he's confident not only in the economy, but he's also confident in the tariff case, the tariffs, everything the president implemented, everything he wedged in order to get the best trade deal possible could get nullified by the Supreme Court. I don't think it will. Either does he. Cut six.
We are going to win the case. It's pretty clear. I sat in the Supreme Court. We're going to win the case. But the fact is the president has all sorts of policies and tools throughout. He's got tariff rules of 232 in my department. He's got 301. He's got 338. He's got tariffs are going to be a part of this administration's national security and national economic protection of the American people. But we are going to win the case. So you can worry about the backup plan, but you're going to watch the Supreme Court back this president, because this president has proven that he can protect America, and IEEPA is protecting America. So we are going to win this case. You heard it from me. I feel confident. I sat through the case. We are going to win.
Well, a couple of things. So that's why this is important, because it could transfer $2,000 to you. I'm not for this. I'm for paying that money and paying down the deficit, less interest on the deficit that we pay, more money towards programs or more money towards paying down the deficit even more. So I'm not having said that, but if they win the tariff case, they're going to put a reconciliation bill together to get people certain bracket. I don't think the upper class need $2,000. So Jason Smith, who pushed for the Big Beautiful Bill, chairman of Ways and Means, said you're going to start feeling and seeing prices go down. Cut seven.
The fruits of the labor that happened with the passage of the Big Beautiful Bill, which is the largest tax cut in U.S. history, will lead to, in just a few months, all Americans will face record tax refunds. And that will be very helpful, because they've seen inflation under the Biden years go up 22%. Of course, President Trump has done a phenomenal job at reducing inflation to the lowest level, right at 2.5%, the lowest level in 4 years. But we need to do more.
And that's what the polls say. So the big test is going to be in Tennessee. There have a district, Mark Green walked away. So now they have to have a special election, I think, in the next 2 weeks. And they expect to hold that seat. You would think a seat the president won by 22 points, a seat where the Democrat was for defund the police, and cited on her Twitter account that 54% of the country thinks it's okay to, in 2020, to burn down a police station. She put that on her Twitter account. And then she's caught on tape saying she hates Pete Nashville and country music. If they don't run away with it, but it's somehow the Democrats see vulnerability and they're pouring money into it. If they lose that seat, along with losing Marjorie Taylor Greene, they'll be in trouble. That's why they're attacking affordability. But I think it's the president's strength. I think he thoroughly understands all the levers you can grab in the economy, push down for better results. So we'll see how that goes. I do think that former Speaker Kevin McCarthy had a great point last night. And that is, when Marjorie Taylor Greene walks away, it doesn't hurt. I think she's way out there, an extremist, used to be a loyalist. I mean, she's never really trustworthy, but she was always conservative and always determined to be with the president. In fact, the last time we were in the Oval Office, Allison, you were there, so was Marjorie Taylor Greene. And what did she say? Marjorie Taylor Greene, Trump looked at her and said, "You were there the day after January 6th. You were there January 7th. You're one of those loyalists." Well, shows you how unsteady she's been. But former Speaker Kevin McCarthy says this is a warning sign. A lot of Republicans feel as though the White House has not been communicative enough to them. And could this have more people retire? You have no room for any more retirements. Cut 43.
She's leaving Congress, but I don't think that's the end that you'll see about her. And I think Look, I've always believed any time you have an elected official that's known by three initials, they're effective on what they do. And I found Marjorie to be very effective, but she's almost like a canary in a coal mine. And this is something inside Congress they better wake up, because they're going to get a lot of people retiring and they got to focus. I think keeping members out of Congress, you only get 2 years to be in the majority. And if the Democrats get you not to work every day for 2 months, that's losing 2 months of the majority.
I hear you. 1-866-408-7669. When we come back, I'm going to bring you the latest on Ukraine. The Russians are now have emissaries in the UAE. Turkey's there. And we have Secretary of the Army Dan Driscoll there. Yesterday, Marco Rubio was leading the talks with Ukraine officials in Geneva, Switzerland. My hope is we can bring this to a close. They knocked a 28-point proposal down to 19 that's less Russia-oriented. Russia has not shown any willingness to give. We'll find out how serious they are to deal. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Every day. America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I said something that was pretty simple and non-controversial, and that was that members of the military should follow the law. And in response to that, Donald Trump said, I should be executed. I should be hanged. I should be prosecuted. He even went on and said something about go get them. I guess sending a mob to round me and the other folks up. So this is, I think it says a lot more about him than it says about me.
Why do you need to remind folks? Why was that necessary? Maybe you should have done that tape before Afghanistan and remind folks you're throwing 22 years of war in the street. You're evacuating and humiliating the country, and you're leaving billions of equipment to be sold by terrorists to other terrorist nations. Maybe you should have posted your tape then. Oh, wait, Joe Biden was president, the guy that was mentally addled and solely making the decision on doing that, despite the urgings, according to them, from four-star generals and admirals saying this is a historically bad decision. Where was the tape then? Senator Mark Kelly on the response of the president that the Pentagon is looking into court-martialing him because he's a retired military officer. That no doubt is brilliant because he's an astronaut. You have to be basically a scientist with that. A fighter pilot, so he's got great courage. Obviously a distinguished career, but as a politician, he has let everybody down except for maybe the left wing of his party. He's supposed to have spoken out. He watched in Arizona as the whole border got bombarded with illegals, and he did nothing except do a stand-up in the midterms to try to save his seat. And now he has to cut a video talking about it is okay to ignore illegal orders. When asked, why are you even doing this tape? Listen to Alyssa Slotkin. Cut 34.
Do you believe President Trump has issued any illegal orders?
To my knowledge, I am not aware of things that are illegal, but certainly there are some legal gymnastics that are going on with these Caribbean strikes and everything related to Venezuela.
Right. So don't do them. Are you calling on sergeants working drones not to do them? You don't think that works against our national security? Or do you think they're real idiots and they don't realize what obligations they have to the country? So I, you know, we're 585, I think it's 585 drone strikes President Obama did on terrorists. They said they were terrorists. They blew them up wherever they were. Fine with it. And you know what? They killed innocent people too, because Al-Awlaki, I think, was with his family. Was with his family when we blew him up. And he's an American. And people go, well, is that right? Even though he was in Africa, we just killed an American. We didn't read his Miranda rights either. I didn't see any tape from Slotkin, who was a congresswoman then, about Barack Obama and how, you know, don't be afraid to stand up to President Obama. So the president's taking action. The Pentagon's making moves. So here's Jason Crow, Cut 32.
How do you respond to these allegations from your colleagues, fellow veterans, that what you have put out there is weakening and corrosive to the military?
Well, these unfortunately are some of Trump's core supporters that are rallying behind the president, and they know better. They know exactly the difference between lawful versus unlawful. We were very clear in the video that what we're talking about is unlawful orders.
So should every soldier, sailor, Marine have a lawyer? You know what? I think it's illegal to be 7 miles off the coast of Venezuela. I don't feel right in Syria. I don't really think that's in America's interest. Is this illegal to be here? We're doing a covert operation. It doesn't seem right. The CIA's working behind the scenes. Maybe it's illegal what they're doing. Or they might be perceived as illegal. So the Pentagon announced on Monday it's investigating Democratic Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona over possible breaches of military law after the former Navy pilot joined a handful of other lawmakers in a video that called for the troops to defy illegal orders. So I could make a tape right now and say, hey, Democrats, no shoplifting. Remember, it's up to you to not shoplift. Don't burglarize. Don't carjack. What's that mean? What is that from? Well, you talk behind the scenes that carjacking is not that big of a deal. So I just thought I'd have I put out a tape on social media just talking about how Democrats should push back against people who tell you to carjack. So good luck with that. You can fight that off. I mean, it's just one of these distractions. I love the fact that Abigail Spanberger says that Trump is looking for this issue to distract. Distract from what? Distract from the big, beautiful bill that passed? Distract from the healthcare remedy that he's putting forward, distract from the Venezuelan push to rid our hemisphere of communists led by Russia and China, distract from trade deal after trade deal. I mean, at the very least, you have to admit that Trump has got a full agenda every day. He does not need a distraction. He even said release the Epstein files. So what do you want now? Yesterday, he signed a bill in AI to expedite the push for using AI for scientific breakthroughs and medical breakthroughs. Here's Christopher Wright, Cut 4.
And to your point about costs, if you look carefully at the data over the last 5 years, the states that have had the fastest growth in electricity demand, like North Dakota leads the list at over 30% growth in electricity demand, their rates have gone down. Texas and Nebraska, rapid growth in electricity demand, very modest price increases. On the other hand, California, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, they've seen declines in their demand for electricity over the last 5 years and huge price increases. Ultimately, increased demand is going to be a tailwind for lower prices. We're going to have a better, more affordable grid 5 years from now with vastly increased capacity.
They're building these huge power centers in South Carolina and in Louisiana and in Mississippi. And it's happening like right now. So he talked about you need all those for AI. The question is, as the demand gets greater in AI power centers and AI needs more demand, utility costs could go up. That's why it's important to build these power stations right away. And that's why it's important, oil, gas, and believe it or not, coal. Responsible way to use coal. You know who's building, I think, a dozen coal stations a week? And it's China. So I care about the environment. President cares about the environment. But first thing first, we cannot lose the AI race because the world's security would be in jeopardy. So I think it's really important. But at the very least, when Abigail Spanberger or other people, and you can tell it's a talking point because they add it to just about every pundit adds it to their analysis. They say, well, the president doesn't want to talk about the Epstein files. The president doesn't want to talk about the economy. Yeah, he does. We'll talk about the economy. Absolutely. You know, they said over the weekend, the president's had a really bad 10 days. He had the Epstein files. What about the Epstein files? What about him? The guy that has it bad is Larry Summers and this Virginia Beach, this Virginia Virgin Islands delegate. That's the one who has it bad. So that's enough. And then when you talk about the economy, the growth is solid despite the lockdown, the shutdown. And you also have a job numbers. It was supposed to be 50,000, was 119,000. The market's gone up. So he's not running from anything from the market. And now the government opened up and it was a major loss for Democrats, obviously. The leadership is paying a huge price for it. I mean, Hakeem Jeffries is being primary and Senator Schumer can't go out of his house without being heckled by his own party. That's not a guy in a losing streak. Daniel Hoffman next. Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You know, it always takes two to tango, but it starts with a plan, and it starts with a president, President Trump, who wants to end this, as he did with Pakistan, India, as he has done so successfully in Gaza, as he has done with basically eliminating the nuclear capabilities of Iran, what he has done between Armenia and Azerbaijan. So this is a president really pushing peace. Worldwide, this is a difficult one. He said that. He said this would be one of the easier ones. No, it was not true. It is one of the more difficult ones. But I'm sure that we will get this done. And yesterday was an important step. And of course, there will be more steps following in the coming days.
And the NATO General Secretary, always positive, Mark Rutte, yesterday on Fox and Friends with me. And that's when we thought it was 28 points. I thought most of them were favoring Russia. Now they knocked it down to 19 after working with the Ukrainians. There's no sense that Russia wants to give it all. I understand that. But the only thing that would get them there is if things changed. Number one, the fact is, after a year of losing 200,000 of their troops, they have gained one percent more of Russia. So they have to go to Africa and have to go to areas of the Middle East in order to get troops. I don't understand that in a nation of 150 million. But they are doing better on drones, and it is overwhelming some portions of missile defense. But I understand the Ukraine is about to unveil a major increase in drone protection. So I think that's really important. Now, the talks go from Geneva, Switzerland, where the Ukrainian delegation, the U.S. delegation is there. Now they switch over to the UAE, where the Russians have an emissary. And the Russians are meeting with, I think, Turkey as a presence. And we're sending over Secretary Army Driscoll to see if they understand or if they legitimately want to get to peace here. And there can't be any peace for Ukraine without legitimate, hardcore security. Daniel Hoffman joins us now, former CIA station chief, served in Moscow among his many places. Dan, are you optimistic at all? Or what do you expect the Russians to be like when they get the 19 more towards Ukraine's liking points?
I'm sorry, Brian. I've never been optimistic about an end to this war. I just don't think we have the leverage over Russia to induce Russia to stop their barbaric invasion of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin, his strategic objective has always been to overthrow the democratically elected government of Ukraine. He'll engage in negotiations, but he does it to ensure that he's asserting the primacy of Russia in his self-designated sphere of influence and not allowing the United States to play the preeminent role in bringing peace to the region. He would never allow that to happen. He's always considered the United States to be Russia's main enemy going back to his KGB days. So I just don't see any evidence that Russia is going to pause in their relentless attacks on Ukraine. They just launched more attacks last night, drones and missiles. They've never agreed to a ceasefire. They've never come to the table with any real interest in negotiating a deal. Moreover, yes, Putin has suffered a million casualties, but he's got a high threshold for pain. He just doesn't care. I'm sorry that President Trump cares a lot more about Russian soldiers than Vladimir Putin does. How Putin would declare victory for a negotiated deal that doesn't accomplish his strategic objective, I think that's a problem for him politically. And what he does with the roughly 700,000 Russian troops who come home, that's like what he witnessed when Russia had to return from Afghanistan in ignominy. So I'm sorry I can't be very pessimistic. You know me well, Brian. I served a lot of years at CIA, spent them trying to see the world through Vladimir Putin's twisted KGB eyes, and that's the best assessment I got.
So this could be a long, drawn-out negotiation. They're probably not going to agree with a lot of the changes. They said they liked the Americans' 28-point plan, which was basically written by Russia, their emissary, Dmitriev, I think his name is, over in Miami. And then they brought it forward, and the president said, hey, this looks good. Let's put it forward. And, of course, it didn't look good. It was very pro-Russian. So to Ukraine's credit, they said, let's work on this. And Rubio said, we made great progress yesterday. Now Zelensky says, I'm willing to hammer out about land with Trump directly, but I wouldn't even go if I'm Zelensky until the Russians show that they're willing to accept some changes to the 28 points.
Yeah, we can negotiate to our heart's content with Ukraine. They're the ones defending their territory and their territorial integrity from Russia's invasion. So it's Russia that would have to stop. I'm sure Putin likes some parts of the plan. Ukraine giving up Donetsk, including pieces of Donetsk that Russia doesn't even control, and limiting Ukraine's military to 600,000 troops, that's a decision for Ukraine, not for Russia to have veto power over. And not allowing European NATO members to station troops in Ukraine, also a non-starter, among other things. But I don't think Putin would have even signed that agreement. I think he probably just saw this as an opportunity to drive a wedge between the United States and Europe, which is another one of his objectives. The thing that we missed, Brian, we could have had a lot of leverage over Putin if way back 4 years ago we had given Ukraine all the military equipment that they needed when they needed it. And now 4 years into the war, it's a different story. But look, President Trump was elected to chart a new course on domestic and foreign policy, so crying about what happened or didn't happen 4 years ago isn't really in our interest. But I've always felt that the best leverage we could get is by arming Ukrainian to the teeth. I don't think this administration wants to do that, however.
I don't either, but NATO is buying weapons. I don't know how quick we're producing those weapons because we have not expanded our industrial base yet. Because we know, I guess Taiwan is waiting 2 years, have already spent the money, and we have not delivered on their weapons. So I don't know what exactly is happening over there. But I would say this. If you think when the pain gets great and it's in their best interest to end it, they could honestly say they got 18% of the country and the whole lark of saying they're going to denazify Ukraine. The way they sold it to get in is the way they could sell it after from their perspective. And right now they have two major oil gas companies, Rosneft and Lukoil, that are now under major sanctions that now is going to affect India's purchases.
Yeah, I think Putin is totally fine bending his knee to China and relying on China to ensure that Russia's economy continues to operate. And China's fine with that, too, because it gives them leverage in their upcoming negotiations with President Trump, who plans to visit Beijing in April. I just don't see that Vladimir Putin is going to see anything but like the CIA used to call it historical placement. When you look at a leader and think about what historical events impact them today that they went through. And for Putin, for sure, it's the collapse of the Soviet Union, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and all that entailed. Yeah, 18% of Ukraine, that was not his objective. It was to take Kyiv. And if Zelensky's still in power and Ukraine is still a democratic country, well, Putin loses, and he's not going to win. His security guys, military and intelligence services are going to see right through this. That's why the CIA has been able to mount some good recruitment operations. They see the massive blood and treasure that Putin has spilled. For what? They didn't achieve their objective. They're not going to achieve their objective. There's no way that Russia's going to take Kyiv. Ukraine is not losing. If you listen to General Jack Keane, he'll tell you they're not losing. We have the leverage. It's just a question of whether we want to use it. If we allow Russia to snatch defeat, or victory, I should say, from the jaws of defeat here, that will have an impact on our world standing, including in the Pacific.
Absolutely. This is a bad deal. Donald Trump's legacy will pay the price. That'll get his attention. I think it has, because he's letting other people that agree with you work on this deal. And I happen to know that from the outside. So that 28 points is when Rubio's in charge, I feel much better. I think he thoroughly gets it. He knows who he works for and he knows the region. So two things.
Agreed.
The Washington Post came out and they said Russia had two objectives. One objective was to get the U.S. to stop arming Ukraine. He thought he could do that with Trump. And number one, to break Ukraine's will. I don't think anybody thinks either one of those areas worked. Am I correct?
I don't think so. There have been some tensions between the United States and Ukraine, our bilateral relationship. And Europe has played a greater role in ensuring that the U.S.-Ukraine relationship doesn't rupture and that we continue to support Ukraine. So, no, I don't think Putin has succeeded in any of this. As odd as it might seem, as counterintuitive as it might seem, I think that makes him more intransigent about not wanting to make a deal. If he doesn't make this deal, he'll blame it on the fact that the first deal, the 28-point deal, was a good one. He'll lie and say he would have signed it because he wants to drive a wedge between us and Ukraine and us and Europe. But that's patently false, and I'm sure that DCIA Ratcliffe is collecting the intelligence to prove that point.
What does security guarantees look like that would be acceptable, Dan, for Ukraine?
I think for Ukraine, it's just a ceasefire at the line of control. Start with that.
How do we stop the next invasion?
Well, I think the first thing you do is you stop this war with a ceasefire. And the way you stop the next invasion is you build out Ukraine's military as much as we need to. We shouldn't put any artificial limits on what Ukraine should be able to build militarily, the numbers of troops, whether foreign troops come in to train Ukraine and work with Ukraine. That's Ukraine's right as a sovereign country to do what they please. Just as Russia is allowed to engage in diplomatic relations and military relations with China and North Korea and Iran, their axis of evil partners. I think we need to go all in. Europe needs to go all in on Ukraine. We need to be the arsenal for democracy. We enjoy $1 trillion worth of trade with Europe. That is going to be at risk if Ukraine were to fall. And the cost to the United States would be astronomic,
and
not just
what,
in terms of our reputation, but economically as well.
And you know how much money and soldiers we'd have to put into Europe to fully secure it? If Ukraine, who it's the second biggest army in Europe, falls in Ukraine in Russia's hands? Or is forced to live life at, diminished numbers. I mean, the way I understand it, they started the war at 200,000, and now they got about 800,000 uniform. And what they've now, in the new 19-point plan, which I have not seen the whole thing, but they said it's capped at like 800,000. But if you have reserves, I was talking to one four-star general still active, and he said, if you have reserves and you have an army of 800,000, I mean, we got 1.4 million in uniform. So if we have reserves, you could easily bulk up to 1 million people quickly. And the thing is, why does Russia care about the size of Ukraine's army? They're no threat to invade unless they plan on invading again.
Well, it's just another violation of Ukraine's sovereignty to say that one country should determine how many troops another country is able to amass. That's just wrong. We shouldn't agree to that, in my opinion. If Europe has to spend more money on defense, they're going to be buying less U.S. goods. If they are concerned about Russia, look, Russia's launching massive attacks, hybrid gray zone operations using drones. They blew up the Germany's military company, Rheinmetall. And if all of that carries on because Putin sees weakness, then Europe will be less of an effective, less of a valuable trading partner for us. And that's bad for us. We want them to make the, when it comes to guns and butter, solve this, make Europe secure, and let Europe go on purchasing goods from the United States. Let us have a positive and valuable commercial relationship. That won't happen if this war ends in Russia's favor. I can pretty well guarantee you of that.
I hear you. I hear you. If you want to put together a problem, now, I mean, if you want to end a problem, you arm up all our NATO allies, get them to 5%, then you set up a coordinated missile defense between them and an offensive capability if needed as well. And then that would dissuade Russia from the next invasion. Lastly, China called yesterday. I didn't know who initiated, but it looks like China called us. And one of the items was Russia, Ukraine. So I'm wondering, since they didn't have bad relations with Ukraine, their relations were fine. Do you think China's offering to do something?
I think China was, look, Ukraine's number one trading partner years ago, before the war. Look, I think what Xi Jinping wants, he knows that President Trump really wants to solve this war. And Xi Jinping is saying, yeah, I'll help you solve the war, maybe. But I want something from you, and that's related to Taiwan. I'm quite sure of that. There's no such thing as, you know, there's only free cheese is only found in a mousetrap, as the Russians like to say. So I think that China would seek to use this as certainly some opportunity to gain some leverage over us in their negotiations with us and over what they want. And so that's something the president's going to have to deal with.
And the takeaway is
a challenge. Yeah, it's a challenge.
And the takeaway is in UAE, you don't expect the Russians to play ball.
Right.
All right. Dan Hoffman, thanks so much. Hope you're wrong, but you haven't been yet. Daniel Hoppin, thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Brian.
Yeah, I hear you.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. 1-866-408-7669.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What if your home security could stop a break-in before it even begins? That's not science fiction. That's Simply Safe. And right now, their early access Black Friday sale is changing how we think about protection. Traditional systems wait until someone's already breaking in. Simply Safe's Active Guard outdoor protection, powered by AI, detects threats before they reach your door. Real security agents jump in instantly, confronting intruders, letting them know they are on camera and the police are on their way. And if needed, setting off sirens and spotlights. It's proactive protection that stops crime before it happens. And here's the best part. No long-term contracts, no hidden fees, and you can cancel anytime. It's been named Best Home Security System by U.S. News & World Report for 5 years straight. And with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try completely risk-free. So, if home safety's been on your mind, this is your moment. Right now, my listeners can take advantage of their biggest sale of the year with this exclusive early access to Simply Safe's Black Friday sale. And save 60% on any new system by going to simplysafe.com/Brian. There will never be a better time to get real security for your home. Go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Stay protected and stay one step ahead with Simply Safe.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
But I think we have to think about how do we do a better job? How do we, you know, maintain maybe some of that frustration we have as we travel this Thanksgiving season? Maybe we should say please and thank you to our pilots and to our flight attendants. I think, again, I call this just maybe dressing with some respect. You know, whether it's a pair of jeans and a decent shirt, I would encourage people to maybe dress a little better, which encourages us to maybe behave all a little better. Let's try not to wear slippers and pajamas as we come to the airport. I think that's positive.
That is Secretary of Transportation Duffy, who's in the news almost every day between the collapse on the air traffic control system that he was not aware of when he took the job at trying to fix, between the shutdown and how they paid the price there, between, sadly, a lot of the air traffic problems that we've had. I think that Sean Duffy has been in the news, almost been on TV almost as much as the president. And now with the travel, with everyone traveling for Thanksgiving, he's talking again about, OK, we're up and running. We're up to full capacity. And can I mention, dress up. Stop dressing like crap. And you don't put your foot on the person's armrest ahead of you on the plane. And if you're going to watch a movie, bring headsets, because we don't want to hear that movie. Just be polite. Can't believe it came down to that, but I thought that was interesting they brought that up. But I mean, that's why if J.D. Vance wasn't so obviously the president's favorite, I would think that Sean Duffy would be one of the people thinking about running for president next. He's been that high profile, that consequential, going on all the shows, taking on all comers, and I think he's been that good. But when it comes to travel, I think it's the same story every year. I could do without talking about it. If you're traveling, you know it's going to be long. If you're traveling, you know it's going to be crowded. If you're traveling, you know with all the planes in the air, there's probably going to be delays. We all build that in now, let alone the problems you have in like Newark, New Jersey. So I thoroughly understand it. And I think no one really blames him. But the whole etiquette thing, I don't have a flying outfit. I either dress casual or dress up. That is it. So that's roughly what's going on. So before I go to break, I just want to bring up this crazy story on the 7th District in Tennessee is now up because Mark Green's retiring. This woman is such a nightmare that's running for the Democratic ticket. Listen to her. It says, Afton Ben, Cut 38.
In 2020, you made some tweets that have since been deleted that were very critical of police.
I'm not going to engage in cable news talking points.
So you don't want to clarify whether you still believe that the police should be defunded?
Once again, I don't remember these tweets, but what I'm saying is that...
What is your position today? How's that on this issue?
I mean, I'm here to talk about my race, which is in literally 9 days.
Are you insane? We are talking about your race. That's MSNBC. They're looking to give you a layup. Just say, I no longer believe we should defund the police. Instead, she basically says she wants to defund the police. And the tweet that was deleted, she was in support of burning down police stations and caught on camera saying, I don't like Nashville.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming forward to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. What an hour we have coming your way. We got Stuart Varney, the number one show on Fox Business. We'll simulcast there. Chad Bronstein, co-founder of one of the most exciting new sports in America, CEO of Real American Freestyle. He, along with Hulk Hogan, founded it. Sadly, Hulk passed away. But now we're starting our third event, Real American Freestyle 03, streaming live Saturday on the 29th. So right after Thanksgiving. And Dave Ignatius is standing by, a columnist for The Washington Post. If anyone knows more about foreign policy in America, I can count him on one hand, and I haven't met him yet. So he's going to bring us inside the hope that we could have when it comes to Russia showing any type of give with these Ukrainian peace talks, as well as what are our options in Venezuela. So before we get to Dave, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I said something that was pretty simple and non-controversial. And that was that members of the military should follow the law. And in response to that, Donald Trump said, I should be executed.
Treason. Senator Kelly's in the Pentagon's crosshairs for taking part in a video urging military members to challenge illegal orders. Without an example, and in my view, cause, this is just going to cause unrest in the armed forces, totally unnecessary, and now he's under scrutiny. We'll see where this goes.
Number two.
Putin wants legal recognition for what he has stolen, to break the principle of territorial integrity and sovereignty.
That is President Zelensky. The president's projection of power, Trump, on the world stage is on display with China, Russia, and Venezuela. We will update all three and explain why I think we're all safer because we have a president confronting our nation's challenges directly.
Number one.
Some are going to come down in weeks, some are going to come down in months. We just had in terms of affordability, we just had the best month in the housing market due to affordability, due to increased supply, best October in 3 years.
Healthcare fix on hold for now as the president and his team go all in on that word that Bessent just used, and that's affordability. Can he drive prices down in 26? How do you view the economy for you and your family? And what do you hope the president tackles next? So let's bring in Dave Ignatius of the Washington Post. Dave, welcome back.
It's great to be with you, Brian, as always.
Okay, so the 28 points on that page were very pro-Russian. I got it. Since that time, Rubio has taken it on head-on. It's down to 19, and both sides feel much better about the 19 points bringing us to peace. Now, as we head to the UAE, where Russia has an emissary, and we send our Secretary of the Army, Driscoll, do you think the Russians are going to play ball?
So they've been playing ball. They initiated this process by saying what they'd like to see in a peace agreement. The Russians are suffering in this war as the Ukrainians are. I think the key days are ahead. Thank goodness the Trump team, Steve Witkoff, Marco Rubio, and others realized that their initial 28-point draft just leaned too hard toward Vladimir Putin, and they made some changes. I wrote after talking to members of the team on Saturday that they were going to do that, that they understood that Ukraine needed more in the way of security guarantees, and they needed assurances. My piece said that they had 100% commitment from the U.S. for continued sharing of intelligence, which, as you know, is crucial. So now the question is, now that this thing is more balanced, less pro-Moscow, what are the Russians going to do? I mean, how much do they want peace? What leverage does the president really have to get them on board? From the beginning, I have felt the president Trump's desire to get peace, to get an end to this terrible war in Ukraine, was something that people should support and work with him on. But it takes two to tango, and we still don't know what the Kremlin thinks.
I mean, put it this way: if they're engaged and they want peace, I'm sure we're going to get something. But my sense is Vladimir Putin might not want it. And even though the Rosneft and the Lukoil, I think, is going to hurt, and it's certainly going to hurt the India purchases of their oil and gas, I'm not sure. And the way I understand it, you may have better sources, Dave. The way I understand it is that after the Gaza deal, October 22nd, Jared Kushner, flying back with Witkoff, said, let's focus on Ukraine. And they came up with a plan. They said, let's go meet with the Russian Dmitriev. And they met in Miami. And that's what prompted this. I didn't think the Russians reached out. And I think that does matter. It might show the level in which they're willing to talk. Is that how you understood it?
That's basically the same understanding. I think it did begin with Witkoff and Jared and the desire to repeat the success that they'd had in Gaza. They saw that where the Gaza talks were opened after the Israelis unwisely attacked Qatar, trying to go after Hamas people there. In the case of Ukraine, there was what they called an inflection point because of weakness on the battlefield for Ukraine in Donetsk and also the big corruption scandal. So they thought, here's an opening, but in a sense they were realizing Ukraine was weak and might be more pliable. I think they've come, and then they did talk to the Russians. But I think this process has gone the way it should. They had a proposal. They got a lot of pushback. They listened to it. The truth is, if this is a pro-Russian peace deal, it's not going to work. The Ukrainians won't accept it. And even if they did, it wouldn't be stable. It wouldn't last. So I think people are now in the zone where they could actually get somewhere.
So Dave Ignatius is our guest. So Dave, what do you think effective security, acceptable security guarantees looks like? Is it troops on the ground where they decide the border, the new Ukraine border is? So getting back that 18% of their land is not going to happen. Giving up Donbass, all of Donbass, I don't think that's going to happen either. So having said that, what does legitimate security guarantees look like for Ukraine?
So my model for this, to be honest, is South Korea. The Korean War ended without a formal peace agreement, but with an armistice. But there was enough of a guarantee in the form of U.S. troops, mainly, in South Korea, that South Korea became one of the miracles of the world after that war. You know, just enormous growth. Successful democracy. It's a country that just went from basically zero to 100. So that's possible for Ukraine. But if they have security on their side of the line of control, so I think that security does require troops to at least to be able to move in and out of Ukraine. In one of my pieces, Brian, I described one idea that the Trump team has, which is let's give them Tomahawks after there's a peace deal, so that they would have deterrent. If the Russians messed around, they have Tomahawks that can hit Moscow. They wouldn't use them unless they were provoked, because if they did, they'd lose all U.S. and European support. But they'd at least have a backup. I think that kind of idea, the issue is deterrence. How do you deter Russia in the future? Things like Tomahawks, things like troops are going to have to be part of the package.
So, Dave, for people listening to us right now that keep saying things to the Nate on both sides, Ukraine, that's not our problem. That's Europe's problem. And Russia, you know, they feel threatened by NATO. It's our fault for expanding NATO too big. What do you say to those people?
So the first thing I say is we didn't invade Ukraine. Russia did. Joe Biden didn't invade Ukraine. Vladimir Putin did. And he did it because of a misconceived idea that Ukraine is part of Russia. It isn't. It's its own country. Now, that's a formal matter of international law. And you can't just invade other countries and expect to topple our governments. That's not how the world works. So I would say that, you know, we have an interest in that basic rule of law, because that's, you know, stability in the world depends on it. I personally admire the Ukrainians enormously for the way they fought back. I just think in terms of the human qualities that we admire, that we give thanks for at this time of year, they've really displayed them. And I don't want us to walk away from them. I'd say to friends I meet, you know, let me tell you about what it feels like in Kyiv when you go there, what you hear from people. Just you know, to think about this not in terms of our politics, but in terms of their, you know, commitment, their suffering. I've been in the hospitals and seen the, you know, the amputees who want to go right back to the front. Why? Because it's their country, because they believe in it. So that's what I'd like my, you know, my folks, my neighbors, my friends to understand about this conflict.
And just to understand, if this ends the wrong way, we're just going to be back again. Maybe it's going to be the rest of Georgia next time. Maybe all of a sudden they're going to decide that Estonia never really belonged to be free. You know, and Lithuania was provocative. They'll make up some story that we got to go take parts of Lithuania back, let alone, you know, more formidable countries like the long border between Finland. So they have to know that this is not going to work and that we're going to be there to back up our allies. And our allies from here on in have to understand they're going to have to buy the weapons, hopefully from us, to defend themselves.
You said it just right. You know, our good name as a country has to mean something. You know, when we make an assurance from administration to administration, it has to be something real there. People are going to just have a different opinion of the United States of America, which is not good.
So we understand there's a couple of things that are going to happen now with Driscoll getting, I guess, read in. He's going to go over the UAE. And we're going to see if Vladimir Putin is sending somebody there that wants to get a deal done. And if they feel as though Russia's playing ball, Zelensky's going to come to the U.S. and meet with Trump and talk about land specifically. Is that the scenario you understand it?
I think that's right. I think if the UAE talks go well, and it's very interesting, I would note, to see the growing role of Dan Driscoll, the Army Secretary, close friend of J.D. Vance's, the Vice President Vance's, in this process. But if those talks go well, I think we will have a next meeting. I think President Trump, quite reasonably, you know, wants to get this done while he thinks there's a moment. I have to say, I don't see Vladimir Putin ready to make a deal. I don't think he wants peace, Brian. I think he wants victory. And President Trump's saying, you're not going to get victory. The time is to settle this war. If he refuses, then Trump has a real dilemma. What does he do then? You know, because he's going to have to significantly increase U.S. pressure. I couldn't predict what he'll do, but if Putin says no, and I think you have to bet, you know, 60-40, he'll say no, then it really gets tough for the president.
No question. Now, China makes a call yesterday to the president. Now, they say the April meeting is now set, and they talked about things, including Taiwan, which is significant. But he also talked about Ukraine. You know, Russia, if China wants this war to end, it ends tomorrow. So what do you think China could possibly have offered, if anything?
So I think China's price for doing more than it's been willing to do to lean on Russia to end this war is a significant U.S. move on Taiwan. And I think that's, you know, that's a tough call. President Trump does not have as strong a commitment to Taiwan as some of his predecessors. I think he sees it more as a supply chain issue. He wants the chips from Taiwan, but, you know, Taiwanese, its status vis-a-vis China matters less to him than to Biden. Biden said several times he would commit U.S. military forces if the Chinese attacked. So I think that's the grand bargain that China would envision. We'll help you solve Ukraine if you'll help us solve Taiwan. That's a reach. That would be very destabilizing.
That's the only offer. Yeah, of course, that's too much of a reach. But I was just wondering if there's anything else, because we hear the more stories you read, the people that know, they are really hurting economically. And I'm just wondering if there's something else there in terms of.
So if China could help make our sanctions against Russian energy really bite. China is a major buyer of Russian oil. And I just had a little bit of intelligence from one of our European allies that things are not going as well for Russia, either on the battlefield in Ukraine or in terms of their suffering damage from Ukrainian long-range strikes, as we might think. But they're hurting more than we realize. If that's true, then the Chinese can increase that pain level some without abandoning Russia in a way that might change the calculus for Putin. I think, that would be the ideal scenario. They'll help us, get to a settlement because they know it's time.
You know, it's amazing, too, because we always seem to miscalculate the strength of Russia when they were the Soviet Union on down. So we probably still don't know exactly how much damage or how hurting Russia is, right?
This report suggested that Russian refining capacity has been hit more, damaged more by Ukrainian long-range strikes than we're generally understanding. That's something I'm going to do some reporting on to see if I can confirm that. But just as Ukraine is vulnerable now, so is Russia. If China got on board saying it's time for this to end, no question that would make a difference.
Lastly, do you think Ukraine needs this to end?
So I think, as Ukrainian friends say to me, this will be a terrible winter. The Ukrainian ambassador told me last week that some wounded veterans had climbed Mount Kilimanjaro as part of a program they have to rehabilitate people. And one of them had said, the one thing you know is that as difficult as today is, tomorrow will be more difficult. That's where they are, right? I mean, it's through this winter, every bad day will be followed by one even worse. But they're tough, and so I would think they would come through this horrible winter, and they'd still be in the battle. They're going to keep fighting.
Yep.
And the Russians have to calculate that this is not an adversary that's going to quit.
And we're not going to stop because NATO now buys our weapons and we get them over to Ukraine. David Ignatius, always great. And I look forward to getting the insight on your columns every day, The Washington Post. Dave, thank you.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you and all your listeners.
Oh, thanks so much. Dave Ignatius, back in a moment.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with The Brian Kilmeade Show. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we are back. And by the way, in about 10 minutes, we're going to find out about the fastest growing sport in the country, Chad Bronstein with Free American Freestyle. And it's co-founded by Hulk Hogan. And now Fox Nation has the exclusive TV rights, and it's great. And then we'll do a simulcast in Varney and Company, and we'll talk about affordability. And that's one of the main things he is talking about. And the other thing that I just want to bring up, and I brought up a previous hour, is that there's in Tennessee, the 7th District is up. And that is Mark Green had it, Congressman, Republican. So he decides to retire, military guy. So he decides to retire, and the seat's wide open. Trump won it by 22 points. Now Democrats are spending millions of dollars, taking a line of credit to do it, by the way, and they're sending in Kamala Harris, evidently they consider her a heavyweight, to raise money for a candidate that's on tape ripping Nashville, saying how much she hates it, and on her social media account says she's for defunding the police and cites that 54% of the American public in 2020 thought it would be a good idea to burn police stations down. She's going against a very good candidate, very well, very conservative in the area. If Republicans don't win this, they are in a lot of trouble in the midterms, even if the economy does turn around. This should be a layup. Worst candidate, very red district. There's going to be a special election next week. And by the way, Mike Johnson can't afford to lose one more seat. Listen to Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, guys. My name is Kennedy Blades. I'm a 2021 Junior World Champ, a 2024 Olympic silver medalist, and a 2025 Bronze World medalist. RAF is honestly a huge, huge production and a huge show. The fans are going to see a lot of amazing matchups that they could probably never see ever happen in wrestling. Sometimes when people just don't make it in the brackets, people never meet up. So the great thing about RAF is you're going to see matchups that you wish happened that are going to happen. I'm excited. I want to say hi to the fans. I want to give the signature. So it's not just like dominant, focused Kennedy. It's also loving, happy Kennedy. And I can't wait to just interact with everyone. I've been looking forward to this since Real American Freestyle was announced by Hulk Hogan.
So that was Kennedy Blade. She'll be taking on Alejandro Rivera for the middleweight championship at 150 pounds. And we're talking about American Freestyle, the latest sport to launch and a big success, maybe the fastest growing in the country. Fox Nation is its broadcast partner, and Chad Bronstein, co-founder and CEO of Real American Freestyle, joins us now because we know what's coming up on the 29th, right after the Saturday, right after Thanksgiving, 9 o'clock Eastern time on Fox Nation. It'll be the third edition of Real American Freestyle. Chad, are you pumped up?
I'm really excited. Yeah. Chicago, I lived in Chicago for about 14 years. Before I moved to Tampa. So it's going back to my wife's from there. Izzy's from there. So for us, it's really exciting. We're almost sold out. It's actually going to be our largest show to date. We've already sold more tickets than both our first two events. And we're pretty, I would assume we're going to be a sellout crowd by Saturday.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Oh, where is the venue and are there tickets available still?
Yeah, so it's at Wintrust Arena at McCormick Place in Chicago downtown. And there are still tickets available, but I think we've sold out the whole lower bowl. So we're now releasing the upper deck.
Wow. So some of the big matchups that are going to be taking place, what should we know?
So the main event's a really cool one. It's Michael Chandler, who's currently a UFC superstar, who's fighting supposedly fighting Conor McGregor at the White House. He's going up against Chad Mendes. Chad Mendes was a two-time NCAA finalist. And Michael was an All-American from Missouri. And so the two of them around the same age, never wrestled before. And also Chad was part of the UFC, also fought Conor McGregor for the title. So that matchup's really exciting for people because they never thought they would see this match, right? So now they get the opportunity to tune in and watch Michael Chandler versus Chad Mendes. That's one big matchup. There's tons of them.
Right. You have Real Woods taking on Jordan Oliver for the featherweight championship 145.
Yeah, so that's also a really exciting one. Woods, you got to meet him, Brian. He was in your studio.
Yeah, in fact, let's hear the promo. You ready? Let's listen. Cut 50.
The competitive part of me is everywhere. It's just something that's in me.
Woods nasty. You get on the mat with him, you watch out. He'll rip your limbs off and he'll go to the death.
His instinct is something I've never seen before in a wrestler.
He has ice in his veins. I'll be sweaty palms shaking in the bleachers and I'll see Real out there looking at me just like... like I'm the one going on and he's the one in the bleachers.
I want to prove that I'm the best. That puts a chip on my shoulder.
Just still so much more.
Sky's the limit.
Yeah, for him to do, for him to influence the sport.
So he's number one in USA rankings right now. He's on the 25-26 USA team. And that's not the headliner because is it possible to be the headliner and be a featherweight or you go by the heavyweights?
No, I mean, it goes by the, he could have been a headliner. He's one of the premier matches. He moved to Chicago and wrestled for Izzy, and he just took third in the world. So after our first event, he beat Darian Caldwell. 2 weeks later, went to the Worlds and took third. So and Jordan Oliver was a two-time NCAA champ. So it's another matchup that you would never see because of the age gap, but everyone's really excited to watch those two wrestle.
All right, so you have undefeated phenom Bo Bassett, 17 years old, set to battle former NCAA champ Darian Caldwell at 145. Let's listen. Cut 51.
Bo was a young kid. We always had a mindset of going after the best competition.
I was 7 years old. I would wrestle in the 10 and under division. When I got to junior high, I would wrestle in high school. And since my sophomore year in high school, I would wrestle college events. It's not new to wrestle a guy like Caldwell who won an NCAA title when I was extremely young. It's just chasing down another lion that maybe people say you can't beat. He's won the NCAA title. He's the Bellator champ. He's got a big name.
He's 126-0 in high school and 52-0 during his junior year with a two-time PIAA Class 2A champion.
Yeah, so he also just won the Bill Ferrell tournament. It's a college tournament. And he won, and he's not in college yet, but he won the tournament. He beat a lot of NCAA champs already. He's a phenom. He's still a senior in high school, right? So he's the first ever on RAF that's actually a senior in high school that's competing against Darian, who was an NCAA champ and a Bellator champ. So this is another matchup, like it's virtual, kind of like you never expect to see this. And that's kind of why we created this card in Chicago. Is really, you know, you're driving that mainstream audience into wrestling, right? Wrestling is a fanatical audience, but now you're bringing that crossover audience, which is that, you know, people that watch Chandler and or Clay Guida, who's also on the card, going up as Caden Henschel. Clay fought, had the most matches in the UFC, the Carpenter, from Chicago, wrestled, going up against Caden Henschel in Chicago. So all these matchups are things that, you know, you never see in a normal, anywhere else in another arena.
And now, how are your rules different from NCAA new rules or international rules?
Well, so NCAA is folk style. So this is freestyle. So it's freestyle Olympic rules in this. So when they're wrestling in college, they're wrestling folk style. So this is differentiates. It's Olympic freestyle rules.
Gotcha. So how many rounds?
There's three 2-minute rounds. And then obviously they get a 30-second break in between.
So Chad, has the world reached out? You know, it's real American freestyle, but is the world reaching out? They're finding out about this?
I mean, every country that has wrestling we've talked to, and on this card, we have the number one pound-for-pound wrestler from Russia, Bahrain, actually, that is wrestling against another local person from Chicago named Tony Caspisi. He's going up against, who's a coach at University of Wisconsin. So we've had on every card, we've had someone from a different country wrestling on it. Last card, we had someone from Canada. We had two guys from Russia. And then on our first card, we had the congressman from India that wrestled on it. So yes, to your question, is the world has reached out. And again, this is the first time there's ever been this kind of stage for wrestling.
Yeah, Chad Brownstein with us now, co-founder and CEO of Real American Freestyle. It's going to have their third event, Chicago. It's going to be the Saturday after Thanksgiving this week, Saturday at 9 o'clock. Watch on Fox Nation. You got Olympic medalists, All-Americans, MMA stars. They step back into their wrestling roots, and they'll come back and they'll compete. What did you learn from the UFC that you're trying to apply here?
Well, the UFC does a great job of matchmaking, right? And they also develop and promote their athletes the right way, really building their brands, and they've done a great job of building that stage. So we take a similar concept, and which is Izzy Martinez, Ben Askren, Lance Palmer, Willie Saylor on the matchmaking side, all spend time to really put together matches that are going to drive excitement for the audience, and then develop, you know, help build these guys and girls' brands, right, so that they could promote themselves and be on that stage. So learned a lot from UFC, WWE, right? Eric Bischoff being our head of production. He really, you know, crushes it with his team on our production quality, if you watch it. And then I would say having Fox, right, as a partner, it's been pretty great, right? It's giving the platform to wrestling that's never been given. So I think that when you put that team together, you're getting this level of excitement across everywhere.
I think we got the same audience. I mean, the ones that watch us wrestle, that's the foundation of the wrestling community, right? It's a middle America.
It's definitely the same audience. And Ryan, again, I always say this on our show, but the first time I talked to you about it, you were the first person I talked to about it and said, hey, you loved wrestling as well. And you said point blank, this is Fox's audience. And then we went and talked to Gavin and Lauren. We pitched it, and we all at this point now know the thesis was correct. It is Fox's audience. Couldn't have asked for a better partnership. And I mean, I think, you know, we're promoting this in the right way. And it's, you know, people are excited about it. It's really cool to see.
Absolutely, Chad. Congratulations. Not easy to do what you've done already and to launch it from zero. And now you're already up to a third event. And then we're going to see it. Hopefully you'll sell out, but you already got a huge crowd at Chicago's Wintrust Arena. And then you could watch it 9 o'clock on Saturday night after Thanksgiving. Chad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
All right. Great. Chad Bronstein helping us out with Real American Freestyle Saturday. I feel bad for the Fox Nation people because they have to go in Saturday night, but I feel good for the Fox Nation viewers because they have something to watch live on Saturday night. Because if you can't watch History, Liberty, and Laughs, this is also almost as exciting when you talk about the best wrestlers in the world going at it in their weight classes. In a time in which some are 28, 30 years old, you don't make the national team. What do? Now you have a place to go, and then you try to become a champion. And a lot of people peak individually in their middle to late 20s. But in wrestling, like gymnastics, if you're a female especially, you're done by then. Now you have some place to go. It's always good. Great athletes, very dedicated, finally getting the spotlight to a sport we all grew up with. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, I do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. Then I squeeze in some calls before we end the top of the hour. Don't move. Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. I'm about to go on to a simulcast with the great Stuart Varney, who's looking at the stock market right now, up 314 points. Why? According to Charles Payne, who talked to me this morning, he said he believes it's pretty obvious now that they're going to be cutting rates. And I think I think the market likes it. And one of the reasons, you know, we got some good news on the jobs report on Thursday, and the market said, if the jobs are too good, they might not cut rates. Think about that. It's a little bit backwards. So let's listen to Stuart introduce me.
There you have it. It is 10:51 Eastern time. That means it's Kilmeade time. And here he is. The Pentagon investigating Democrat Senator Mark Kelly over a video telling members of the military to defy Trump. Senator Kelly, here's his response. If this is meant to intimidate me and other members of Congress from doing our jobs and holding this administration accountable, it won't work. I've given too much to this country to be silenced by bullies who care more about their own power than protecting the Constitution. All right, what do you make of all of this, Brian?
I think it's one of the most disappointing videos I've seen. If you told me that that video that would had all these veterans and the CIA operative in Slotkin, if I said, hey, there's a Democratic video out that talks about telling the troops it's okay for you to disobey orders, wrongful orders, I'd say okay, that's the view. That's probably the squad. But to think that you could serve in uniform and think it's okay to just come out and without any cause just say, hey, by the way, if you're in uniform, you do not have to follow unlawful orders. Well, what orders are you talking about? That's not important. Well, you said in the past in 2017, according to Mark Esper, to shoot protesters in the leg. Well, that's not an order. That's a comment. Oh, you said, when you were on the debate stage in 2016, you said that you were going to send troops into the cities. Well, that was a debate. That was almost 10 years ago. So what are you talking about? Well, you know, we want them to examining the Venezuela operation. We were blowing up drug boats. Really? You didn't really care when Barack Obama was arbitrarily blowing up Al-Qaeda and ISIS. I kind of loved it. But we never said, wait a second, if you're a drone operator, you don't have to do that. No, nobody cut a tape. You know, Lindsey Graham didn't cut a tape. He's a JAG officer. He didn't cut a tape saying, hey, you don't have to follow Barack Obama's orders. What is that about? So right. To me, it is totally unwarranted. It's beneath them with this entire tape. But I don't know where the investigation's going to go under Mark Kelly. It's there to stress him and distract him and maybe put resources in the staff to defend his actions. But to me, it's basic insubordination. It's bringing politics, bringing your military uniform and all your medals into politics.
Right.
So,
what consequences should Kelly face?
I don't think there's necessarily a strong legal case against him. They got to look into court martialing him.
Right.
But I think the examination and make people accountable. I think that's the most you can look for. And I just think it's totally irresponsible. I mean, it just. And then they're saying, I like this. Abigail Spanberger from the CIA. She says, well, Donald Trump's looking for a distraction. Really? He's looking for a distraction from what? Venezuela? From what? The Ukrainian talks? From what? The going ahead for trying to fix health care that Obamacare jammed down our throats? What distraction do you think he's looking for? I mean, I don't understand it. The guy works all day and night. He doesn't need a distraction.
I got to get you on this, Brian. Records show that the man accused of setting a woman on fire aboard a Chicago train repeatedly violated his court order's curfew and movement restrictions. Why does this happen so frequently? Why are these guys able to roam the street?
I don't know. But I'll tell you what. This judge came out and she made a statement that I don't even know how she sleeps at night. She should be forced to go visit that victim in the hospital. Her name is Judge Teresa Molina Gonzalez. She denied prosecutors' request to detain him despite his 80 transgressions, despite their warning that he posed a threat to the physical safety of the victim and their community. During the hearing, the judge told prosecutors, I can't keep everybody in jail because the state's attorney wants me to. Really? He's wearing a bracelet. He's trying to cut it off. You're telling him, everybody knows he's a danger, violent criminal. And then you send him out. He buys gas, chases this woman down after he doses her, lights her on fire. And now she's struggling for her life because a judge won't do what they're supposed to do. And it's sickening. That judge should be forced to visit her in the hospital and understand the pain, that it was totally unnecessary because she wouldn't do her job.
Totally unnecessary. Out of control. Brian Kilmeade, you're all right. Thanks so much for joining us. You have a great Thanksgiving, Brian.
You too, Stuart. Thank you and your family. Absolutely. So, yeah, I just to finish up that story because I had not been talking about it. Judge Teresa Molina Gonzalez in Chicago. Now, no one's really complaining about ICE this week because you got the shooting that took place during a tree lighting over the weekend. Shooting, tree lighting. I guess you're going to blame ICE for that. And then you have a guy with a record, a record of 80 separate transgressions, and almost all of them are violent. And they let him out with an ankle bracelet, and he goes and buys gas, finds a woman, throws it on her just arbitrarily in a subway, on a train, and then chases her down because she knew what was going on, and then lights her on fire. And he laughs. Everybody knows this guy should not be out. So that's a terrible mayor, terrible police chief, an understaffed police force who are not backed up. That's why when this administration put resources in, they're able to pick up the number of arrests, pick up the number of assaults, and you see a decrease in overall gun crime. And do you remember 4 years ago? You might not have. It all blurs together. O'Hare Airport was overrun with homeless because there was a sense that we have all these homeless coming in from Texas and others because they said, if this is not a border problem, it's an American problem. If your party is not going to batten down the hatches at the border, you're going to feel some of the pain we feel. And they put them in O'Hare Airport, a big danger. Do you know who is also in support of that airport? Big story on Fox News Digital, Joe Biden. He said, yeah, put them in the airports. Put them in the airports. Now we know how many criminals came across, how many terrorists came through, how many gang members came through, how many drugs came through. And not only do they go to your city, they're in the airport. And that's what we had to see as we went back and forth. And also, you probably boarded a few planes where you looked to the left and right and you saw a name tag. People just spirited through the TSA. Spirited through the TSA because they didn't have any ID. And they're not really eligible to get a ticket, but they were getting free tickets on your tax dollar. That's the previous administration.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. I appreciate you. Meanwhile, listening every single day, and hopefully you're with us every day. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen is standing by. You know, the senator from Oklahoma. Things are heating up. We'll talk about affordability leading into the holidays. And is there a health care compromise in the works? Samuel Katz at the bottom of the hour. He's got a new book out called Architect of Espionage, The Man Who Built Israel's Mossad into the World's Boldest Intelligence Force. We know about Mossad, the IDF the other day found the largest tunnel complex yet with 90 rooms right in the middle of Gaza. Hopefully that is the mother load, because they also wiped out two officers and killed an officer on the Hezbollah side, the Lebanon side, who was in his apartment in the fourth floor. Amazing and necessary. Before we get to Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I said something that was pretty simple and non-controversial, and that was that members of the military should follow the law. And in response to that, Donald Trump said I should be executed.
Senator Mark Wayne, Senator Mark Kelly, treason. That's what it borders on. Senator Kelly is in the Pentagon's crosshairs for taking part in a video urging military members to challenge illegal orders. No joke. They really need a challenge from former military members. Are you just trying to undermine President Trump on the world stage? I think so. He thinks so, too.
Number two.
Putin wants legal recognition for what he has stolen, to break the principle of territorial integrity and sovereignty.
Presidential projection of power on the world stage is on display. China, Russia, and Venezuela. We will update you on all three and explain why I think we are all safer because this president is confronting our greatest challenges immediately.
Number one.
Some are going to come down in weeks. Some are going to come down in months. We just had in terms of affordability, we just had the best month in the housing market due to affordability, due to increased supply, best October in 3 years.
But we're not there yet as a country. Healthcare fix on hold for now as the president and his team go all in on affordability. Can he drive prices down in 26? How do you view the economy in your world with your family? Whatever you say is the right thing. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, welcome back, Senator.
Hey, Brian, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much for joining me on this Tuesday leading up to Thanksgiving. First off, what's going on with health care and a compromise? Have you been read into what the White House is working on?
Well, actually, I had a meeting with the president yesterday at the White House, and I can tell you he's laser focused. His entire team is laser focused on getting health care that actually works for the American people. What we do know for a fact is that the Affordable Health Care Act, that aka Obamacare, isn't affordable. It's not working. It's went up 200, premiums went up 231% since the conception, even though we were told it would go down 25%. Premium packages in our health care plans are very narrow now. So, we have to work on how do we get there, but it's very, very complicated because truthfully, affordable health care, aka Obamacare, it destroyed the market and the ability for choice, and it subsidized so much of these healthcare plans that it changed the whole makeup of the way the healthcare industry did it by grouping everybody together. So it took healthy individuals, put them with the very sick individuals, and it took away the freedom of choice for those plans. And since there's less plans, the healthcare industry is like, when we lose healthy people, we have to raise a price for the sicker people. And there's a couple of options that we've been looking at. One, we have to make changes to Obamacare. One of them is, what is it that is Obamacare that made mandates that each healthcare plan had to cover. I mean, some of it had to cover catastrophic insurance. Well, not all plans need catastrophic insurance. Some of it had, a lot of it mandatory that it carries maternity care. Well, a healthy male doesn't need that, or a 60-year-old female doesn't need that. And so, how are we taking out some of the mandates that are required, and then how do we still keep the free market available? Mm-hmm. How do we treat healthcare more like homeowners insurance or auto insurance? Right, you got a driver that doesn't ever have a ticket. He or she's never had an accident. Their auto insurance is much cheaper than the guy who drives fast and has accidents all the time. Well, a healthy individual that takes care of themselves, that's not obese and never smoked, never drank, probably shouldn't have the same coverage and have to pay the same premium as the guy who doesn't take care of himself. So it's very complicated. We're working with it. The president's laser focused on it. The thing is where the Democrats work with us, and that's the problem. And I don't know how you get past that impasse.
So they just want give the subsidies that were there to the healthcare companies, and that's not going to work. To insurance companies, that's not been effective.
Well, all they want to do is try to subsidize insurance companies to say we'll pay a percentage of the premium, so therefore the person can bring down their insurance, but it really doesn't bring it down.
Yeah.
And what the president's point is I don't want to give the insurance companies a one penny. I mean, their stock prices went up from pre-Obamacare from $30 a share to some of it's $330 a share now. They're making a lot of money, which is fine. We want them to make money. But at the same time, American taxpayers are subsidizing that.
It's crazy. Senator, the other thing to keep in mind, that you know, is that Aetna, Cigna, United, they all dropped out. They said these exchanges, we're losing billions by doing these exchanges. So the theory with Obamacare, and I can't write the book on Obamacare, so I haven't memorized all the principles. It's been so long. But a theory was that these companies would be competing for individuals, and they would drive the price down. But they just bailed out and said, this is not going to work. All I get is sick people. And then the mandate, the president got rid of the mandate because it's unconstitutional. So that means you're not going to fine me $1,000 because I don't take Obamacare anymore. So they couldn't even use that money. So this thing is falling apart. But how do you fix it in real time this year is the key, not to rehash what happened in 2016.
It's 100% true. So, and I can tell you some of the things that we've been throwing out. It's starting HSAs, which is healthcare savings accounts. For individuals, rather giving subsidies to the insurance companies, we get to the people that's buying it. We start working with the states to say, hey, what is the sickest population? The sickest population really isn't the elderly. It's the pre-existing conditions, ones that have specialty medicine that costs a tremendous amount of money, specialty care, and it's long-term care. How do we take the $40 billion a year that we're giving to the insurance companies, give that to the states and let them take care of those with a pre-existing conditions? And how does that work, and how can the state manage it? And it not get so ridiculous that they treat it like disability, like Social Security disability, where they put everybody there. How do you actually have people that qualify for it? That's a conversation that took place yesterday. How do we bring back the free market? And we need to do this pretty quick because we want to avoid another shutdown, and we're afraid the Democrats are going to lead us to another shutdown, because the truth is the reason why they reopened it was Ledge Branch didn't pay their staff. Well, we reopened it. The SNAP program with the ag, we reopened it and we funded it. So there's not SNAP that's going to be able to be shut down, and Ledge Branch, which funded their staff, isn't going to shut down. So really afraid that they'll take us straight into another shutdown. So we really do want to work with them to fix the healthcare system, not patch it. There's a difference. They want to patch it by putting more subsidies. We want to fix it to have the free market work again. And the conversation isn't going well.
Really? Okay. So I had Senator Shaheen on, and she says you guys were showing bipartisan cooperation. I had her on television today, but you don't think that's accurate?
Well, one thing we did go by there is the president said he wants to really work hard on a bipartisan manner, but there's an impasse that we're going to have a very hard time getting away with, because the Democrats, they want to basically leave the Hyde Amendment out of it, which is the Hyde Amendment, you know, for your listening audience, it prevented federal tax dollars from being able to be used for abortion. It doesn't prevent abortion. It doesn't prevent the state. It just says federal tax dollars can't be used for it. Well, since we subsidize so many of these programs, especially with HSAs, which is federally subsidizing health care plans, but it goes to the individuals, we have to have something that's an assurance that can't be used for abortion, because it's the law. Hyde Act is the law. It's the law. And there's a big impasse on that they don't want Hyde protection on HSAs. And so if to do that, then we would have to literally pass a law to get away with the Hyde Act. And that is a very difficult impasse for the Democrats to get past. And right now that's where we're stopped on. And it shouldn't be. I mean, it's like I said, that has been the law of the land for decades now. And they're trying to do an end around on it. And we're just saying, we're not trying to change the law of the land. We're not trying to make this about abortion at all. That's not the case. We just got to make sure that we're not breaking the law with a law that we write, unless you guys are wanting to do away with the Hyde Amendment, which isn't going to pass. The American people do not want to subsidize abortions.
I think that's pretty clear. So, Senator, the other thing you could do to avoid January 30th, get all the appropriation bills done and passed, right? And you got how many are left?
In a perfect world.
Yeah. How many? Is that not realistic?
Well, I mean, you got to think, 4 years underneath Chuck Schumer running the Senate and 4 years of Joe Biden, they didn't pass a single appropriation bill. They CR'd everything. The last 2 years, they didn't even bring one to the floor. So Chuck Schumer doesn't want to do appropriations. He wants to do a CR. Why do the Democrats want to do a CR? Because a CR is a continuing resolution of Obama-era spending. So we need to do appropriations. The House can do appropriations. The Senate, we have to have 60 votes. And we only have 53, and you can take Rand Paul out because he never votes for any spending bill. So that means we start at 52. And so we have to have 8 Democrats to support any funding bill. We can probably realistically, since we've already did 3, we can probably do 4, maybe 5 more. I know we could probably, we should be able to do defense. We should be able to do CJS. We should be able to do T-HUD and Interior. Which CJS, by the way, is Commerce, Judiciary, Justice, and oh my Lord, I forgot what S is. Everybody's going to be making fun of me on that one. And so just for people to understand, the Interior deals with our public land, Native American issues, a whole bunch of stuff. And so if we could get those 4 done, plus the 3 we already have done, that basically funds 87% of discretionary spending. And so the last, because that's 7, so the last 5 bills is 13% of the government, which you could realistically do a continuing resolution on the rest of it, because the other ones are very difficult to get through. So Brian, I'm not holding my breath that Patty Murray, the ranking member of APROPS, I sit on APROPS too, but she's the ranking member of it for Democrats, is going to work with us, because even though all these bills that we're talking about have passed bipartisan, I'm talking like 25-2 out of the committees, but when they get to the floor, these people that voted for them out of the committees aren't voting for them on the floor because Chuck Schumer is telling them not to.
Right, and you got to get to 60. But to get out of committee, you could do the committee with a simple majority, right?
Yeah, well, but they're already out of committee. But they've already passed out of committee by overwhelming bipartisan support. That's what I'm saying. We've only had 2 people out of the appropriations that's voted against the appropriations. So it's like 25-2 that they've come out of the committee. So they come out to the floor bipartisan. Typically, if you vote for it out of committee, you vote for it on the floor. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't been the case in these appropriation bills that we've tried to bring to the floor. They've stopped every single one of them.
So real quick on Venezuela, it looks like the president has declared a certain group, a terror group. It looks like we have aircraft carrier. We have air assets, naval assets 7 miles off their coast. It's very expensive to keep this type of firepower in the region. What could you tell our audience? Where are we heading?
Well, we're not putting boots on the ground in Venezuela, but we're protecting international water to keep the drug trade and the human trafficking from coming back and forth on our shores. What the president is doing here is being very proactive. I get people, the Democrats and some of the other people say, it's a waste of money, it's expensive. But what's expensive is fighting the war on our own streets. We've had more deaths because of these cartels bringing in narcotics, fentanyl, and other drugs into our streets. In 2024, we had more deaths than we did in the entire Vietnam War. And so it's affected every single one of us. It's affected every one of our communities. It's affected our families.
Yeah.
It's affected our friends. And so the president is saying, listen, we're protecting international water that you're trafficking this through. And if you want to be too proactive, we're going to continue to take this fight to you. So the last time we were actually able to do that was underneath Ronald Reagan, when he was very proactive in entering into Central and South America and stopping the drug trade there. And we saw a huge drop in drugs. But the president's not only just doing it in international water, but you got to remember what DHS is doing here inside the United States and ICE is. they're breaking up these drug rings in these major cities. It's not just going after federal fugitives, which are illegals that are in this country legally because they are federal fugitives. They're breaking up the drug rings and the trafficking rings that's trafficking the dollars in and the drugs in and the dollars out. And they're also breaking up the distribution of it in the city. So we're having a full press of it, and they are terrorists. They are terrorizing. These are domestic terrorists, international terrorists. They're becoming domestic terrorists that are terrorizing every street, every town, every city, and every state in our country.
So do you think the conversation between Maduro and the president is simple? You got to go, and Russia will take you.
Yeah, we've made it very clear. We'll allow him to leave the country. You have run a country that was at one time the shiny example in Central and South America. They were a perfect example of a partner of ours.
Yep.
We worked very closely to him. He's rent the country. Literally, he's destroyed the country. And we're saying, hey, leave. We will let you leave. Even though we have a bounty on your head, yep, we will let you leave. Go to one of these countries. Go to Russia if you want to. But you've got to leave. Otherwise, we're just going to continue to choke your country out.
I hear you. That's a nice phrase. Senator Markway Mullen, thanks so much. Interesting time. So glad you're there. Appreciate it.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow starting November 30th on FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
He's so busy,
he'll make your head spin.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Our family has been scrutinized, attacked under a microscope. I would probably argue more than any family.
Well, of course, because your father-in-law is the president.
Yeah,
twice.
But it's not just that he's the president. It's that he's Donald Trump as the president. I mean, they've gone after all of us in
they
such
will go after everybody,
an aggressive way.
They didn't go after Obama and Clinton in an aggressive way.
If not like this, Bill.
Oh, please.
Really? When did you see
Clinton,
Obama and Clinton's residences, personal private property, raided by the FBI? When did they have indictments against them to put them in jail for the rest of their life?
Well,
that everybody can agree were a little outrageous, Bill. Like, really?
There you go. Larry Trump on Bill Maher's podcast, pushing back, but it was a very good conversation. That was a little friction there on that, but... And one thing that Bill Maher said in the beginning is, I can't get a Hollywood star to come on here. I don't really get Democrats that want to engage. But every time I ask a Republican to come on, almost all of them say yes. Whether I'm critical of them, like Ted Cruz or Donald Trump, come on over for dinner. So I think he appreciates that. He's got a unique lane. Quick note. I'm going to be back on stage on Valentine's Day. So go to History, Liberty, and Laughs. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. I'll see you in Fort Myers, Florida. Coming up next, Samuel Katz, New York Times bestselling author, author of Architect of Espionage, the man who built Israel's Mossad into the world's boldest intelligence force.
Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Welcome back, everybody. Brian Kilmeade here. It's my pleasure to bring in Samuel Katz, New York Times bestselling author with more than 20 books on the Arab-Israeli conflict. There's plenty to write about. He's got a brand new book out now called Architect of Espionage, the man who built Israel's Mossad into the world's boldest intelligence force. And there's not a person on the planet who's not in awe of what the Mossad has done. We're able to pull off especially since the October 7th attack, between what they were able to, how they were able to infiltrate Iran, how what they were able to do with the world's premier terror force, and that's Hezbollah, and then the way they've been able to help take apart Hamas, even though they're not dead yet. Samuel Katz, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
First off, when you look at what the Mossad has done, I think perhaps the world had to take notice about Iran. The way when it was time to take out Iran's nuclear assets, the knowledge that they had, the assassination of the officers, the location of the facilities, without giving away best practices, how long was Mossad focused on Iran?
Well over 20 years. When Meir Dagan, the subject of the book, took over the Mossad in 2002, he had two primary missions. One was to fight and join the United States and the other international partners in the global war on terror. And second was to prevent rogue nations, primarily Iran, from gathering weapons of mass destruction, specifically nuclear weapons. And a very concerted effort was made to create networks, gather intelligence, become embedded in the very fabric of the Iranian program so that at a point of opportunity or national necessity, those assets could be taken out.
So there was mass executions in Iran afterwards. They thought everybody was compliant. So was it, do you think you have a compliant Iranian society there that hated their government to the point where there might be cooperation with Israel?
So one of the luxuries of battling a nation like Iran, which is a very strict, authoritarian, religious fundamentalist nation, is that there are a lot of minorities in the country who are persecuted and who would love nothing more than to see regime change. So they are natural allies of a nation like Israel or the United States to assist in doing anything to weaken and compromise the ruling mullahs in Tehran.
Perhaps the most impressive was after the funeral of the president of Iran, when Hamas leadership went there for the funeral, they would basically take it out in their villas.
Yes.
That's absolutely incredible.
The remarkable thing is that after October 7th, Israeli intelligence rebounded. It took a major blow, but it also showed that the focus of Israeli intelligence, primarily the Mossad, was always Hezbollah and Iran, that they viewed as existential threats, and Hamas was a lesser threat. And of course, history proved that Hamas had a potent ability to attack and make Israel suffer. But the real threat, the threat to the existence of the Jewish state and Western democracies nearby in Europe, was Iran and its proxies.
So you were saying before that there was October 7th was supposed to be much worse. What was there was supposed to be a coordination between Hezbollah and Hamas?
So Hamas, for all of the mastery that they've celebrated on social media about how brilliant they were on October 7th, they stole the playbook from Hezbollah. In 2018 and 19, the Israel Defense Forces sealed a group of tunnels that Hezbollah had dug deep in the mountains connecting the two countries. And they were supposed to be used as attack avenues to capture a section of northern Israel, kill scores of civilians, and take scores more back as hostages. The thinking of Hamas leadership was that they will strike on October 7th, a holiday when Israel was not on top alertness. Their allies in Hezbollah would join in with missiles and attacks mm-hmm. through tunnels. The Iranians and the Syrians and the Iraqis would see that this is Israel is at its most vulnerable. It's under attack on two fronts. It would join in, and then there would be another uprising, a third intifada in the West Bank, where Palestinian terror groups would strike out, and Israel would be incredibly vulnerable. And indeed, after the October 7th invasion, Israel fought a war on seven fronts.
Really? No doubt about it. But Hezbollah was slow off the mark because the communication was not great between the two terror groups?
Hezbollah was slow off the mark because in 2006, the last time it attacked Israel, the blow that the Israelis dealt to them was crippling. And the Mossad also initiated scores of operations, including Ponzi schemes, where it impoverished billionaires who worked for Hezbollah, who were in the Hezbollah leadership. So Hezbollah didn't want to engage in an all-scale war. This was not something they had been forewarned about. And instead, they just sent out missiles piecemeal to show the Arab street that they were still...
And they cleared out the northern part of Israel, right?
They did. There were hundreds of thousands of Israelis who were refugees because they couldn't live there because of the rocket attacks. And then when Gaza was more or less stabilized, Israel...
Did the pager attack.
Did the pager attack. And the pager attack was perhaps one of the most remarkable operations
ever.
And it could be said it took 15 to 18 years from conception.
2006?
Yeah. In 2006, after the Lebanon War, I write about it in the book, Meir Dagan sat with his deputies, and Hezbollah had fought a bitter war against Israel. And they were, one late night, they were thinking, what should we do? And one of them said, why don't we just kill them all? and the operation took its progress. They were figuring how, when, and the pager became one of the tools, then the radios. And it was perhaps the most decisive blow ever against a terror group that up until 9/11 killed more Americans than any other group out there.
And then a couple of days ago, they took out one of the Hezbollah leaders, I think, in the fourth floor of an apartment.
Yes.
So the intelligence is incredible. That's the point.
The intelligence is pinpoint and accurate. And Hezbollah and the enemies of Israel have now been so compromised that there is very little that they do that the Israelis ultimately don't become aware of.
The name of the book is The Architect of Espionage, the man who built Israel's Mossad into the world's boldest intelligence force. And not many people are not in awe, even if you're an enemy of Israel, and there are some, you have to be in awe of what they were able to accomplish and be intimidated as well. And that, I think, will help the Abraham Accords as soon as they get some semblance of peace. But when you talk about Hamas, Hamas is not dead yet. A couple of days ago, they found a tunnel complex with 90 rooms in it. And they said it's the biggest complex we've found so far. But you said that there's a lot of crazy stuff that they already found that surprised them in those tunnels.
The tunnel network exceeds the scope of the London Underground. The amount of money that was used to build it at the expense of the local Gazans is enormous.
Using foreign aid, right?
Using in many cases U.S. taxpayer money, U.S. aid, and all the programs that were seized. The entire Gaza Strip was to be used as a launching pad of terror. It was. The citizens of Gaza were used as human shields and human sacrifices, and Israel is perhaps the one nation on earth that is first world, that has a European standard of living, that is neighbors with a third world nation, third world entity, that fights a barbaric type of war where human beings are nothing more than fodder.
And they get global condemnation if any civilian dies who's never been targeted. Those are casualties that look to be avoided. You drop flyers. You text message people, you move people out the best you can in a very dense environment, but the world has to condemn you guys when the focus for the other guys is to kill civilians.
Absolutely. Not one Gazan was ever allowed to enter one of the deep Hamas tunnels that could have prevented...
And where do those tunnels go? Schools? Mosques?
Homes? Yeah. UN facilities? Yeah. Hospitals? Everything that could be termed as a civilian target, as a no-go target. Anything flying the UN flag will undoubtedly host a major network of Hamas tunnels.
And you say Hamas is infiltrated everywhere. They're all over the place, through Europe. And there certainly have people, we've heard from hostages, and you probably know more. I know you know more. The hostages said that there was direct contact with these protests, these college protests in America.
Yes, well, don't get me started on that. But
I don't mind you starting on that.
Okay,
our audience loves that.
Well, I'll tell you the connection between October 7th and what's going on today. October 7th proved to Israel, first of all, that forget the nation status, they're Jews, and they're going to be targeted and hunted no matter what. Second, it proved that Israel lives in the Middle East, and all that separates that European lifestyle from third world terror, a Somalian Mogadishu, is a dirt road and a barbed wire fence. It also proved that the diplomats and the million-pound brains that have tried to figure out two-state solution never got it right. And from free Palestine and from river to the sea is all about eradicating the Jewish state, and that what was the plan all along. And it shows that the next war for the Middle East is already underway. It's not being fought in the rubble of Gaza. It's not being waged in the rolling hills of southern Lebanon. It's being fought on the streets of London and, sadly, now on the streets of New York City and at Gracie Mansion and City Hall.
You believe that he is a jihadist?
Mamdani?
Yeah.
I think Mamdani is someone who supports the destruction of the Jewish state. His father is a professor who has glorified suicide bombers and his mother is a filmmaker who has never allowed any of her films to be shown in Israel out of hatred for the state of Israel. So he was brought up, he was reared and built into what he became.
Samuel Katz is our guest, and we're talking about, let's talk about immigration for a second. It looks like Europe is waking up. First, they were condemning us here in America for doing what Trump's doing. You seal the border, you find out the criminals amongst us. They just today, I think, finally were condemning any association with CARE and the Muslim Brotherhood. But now Europe, for the longest time, they condemned us. But now they're trying to follow the Denmark model. Denmark says if you're going to come, that Denmark's confining asylum seekers to dorm rooms in a former sanitarium, requiring them reimburse taxpayers. The Swedish lawmakers may require public employers to turn in suspected illegal immigrants and authorities. France and the UK are instituting strict language policies, and some are considering one of the most controversial measures, deporting illegal immigrants into countries other than their own. They're finally waking up, and they're realizing they've been totally infiltrated. They're losing their identity, and the illegal immigrants, I don't care about their circumstances. They have no interest in their country. They want to bring their mores and their values to the country they're going to. And we see that France and England is a mess, and they're trying to do it here in Texas, and it just got stopped. But do you think we're sobering up in time, Sam?
I don't know if it's in time. The the Democratic left-wing elements of the Democratic Party and the Muslim Brotherhood and those forces have formed what has traditionally been known as the Red-Green Alliance. And they've infiltrated politics. They've infiltrated universities. They've absolutely hijacked the American mind into thinking that the West is bad and everything anti-Western is good. October 7th became a rallying cry.
Mm-hmm.
It became a cult, a new religion, anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism. The keffiyeh became the new prayer shawl. The left-wing elements of the Democratic Party became its temple. And social media became its cathedral, where the views are spewed and the hatred is just spread out of control. And it needs to be stopped one way or the other. Otherwise, we in the West, Western nations, in Europe and here, will find ourselves in very dire straits. And Canada is the perfect example of that, that has gone completely backward in its view of its very core principles and ideals.
Right. And they got a left-wing guy there now who thinks they're better off with China than America.
Yes.
So that's fascinating. So a couple of things to bring up. Number one, how do you view Qatar?
So Qatar is both the person who sets fire to your home and then the one who brings the hose and helps you put out the fire. They play both sides to the middle very, very well. They are a small nation, one that...
So rich.
Qatar doesn't fight wars. It buys outcomes. And they also, its leaders, are avowed followers of the Muslim Brotherhood. And they've hosted the Taliban. Hamas leaders watched October 7th unfold live in Doha. They have so much power in the influence they have purchased. They're very, very hard to counter. And I believe that one of the moves made by President Trump to ban the Muslim Brotherhood is one step in the direction to check them in.
Because Qatar's complex, because they come here and they say, hey, you know what, Israel likes the fact that they have somebody to talk to. They know where to reach Hamas when they have to deal with them prior to October 7th. But Sam, we're just scratching the surface. We've got to have you back. Congratulations on the book, The Architect of Espionage, the man who built Israel's Mossad into the world's boldest intelligence force, Samuel M. Katz. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
So welcome back, everybody. I don't really care about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I never thought she was a plus. I thought she was self-centered. She was loyal to Trump. She came in. She had such wild things to say about Jewish space lasers and everything when she was a candidate. The Democrats didn't even put her on a committee, and no Republican went to bat for her. Kevin McCarthy saved her, and then Mike Johnson kept her kept her safe, in other words, amongst extremists. And then she quickly decided that she wants to turn on Trump when he wouldn't back her, apparently, for a Senate seat. But she's leaving. And now that shortens, that slims down the majority even more, at least temporarily, in the House. Kevin McCarthy says, don't dismiss the impact of Marjorie Taylor Greene. Listen up. Cut 39.
I think she's running for president, not for the Senate. Remember, this all stems from Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has never passed a bill, but he's a movement politician. He brought you AOC, Madani. And this is what AOC helped him win that mayor's race. Remember when no one else would make a decision? She's in the parade. She's campaigning. I do not believe she could become the nominee, but if she makes a run and she has a block of votes, she could become a cabinet member if Democrats were to win.
So here he is talking about that's important, but listen to this.
She's leaving Congress, but I don't think that's the end that you'll see about her. And I think, look, I've always believed that any time you have an elected official that's known by three initials, they're effective on what they do. And I found Marjorie to be very effective, but she's almost like a canary in a coal mine. And this is something inside Congress they better wake up, because they're going to get a lot of people retiring
if you don't pay attention. Make sure to watch Fox and Friends tomorrow. Be back here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Always BrianKilmeade.com for all my past books. I sign them and send them out, especially for the holidays. George Washington's Secret Six, Thomas Jefferson, Tripoli Pirates, they're all there. See ya.